He gave me his dazzling white smile, turned on his heel, and marched off to mingle. Glow was beside me.
Are you okay? She asked. You went white just now. Was it because you were standing next to a demon?
He's not a demon.
We don't know that for sure. His skin is a strange color.
It's spray tan. People were clustering around me, lining up for Bananas Foster.
You'd better get cooking, Glow said. These people don't look like they have a lot of patience, and I hope you brought a lot of bananas because everyone in the room is in line.
I could use an assistant. Stay here and help me serve. I had a single burner on the serving trolley, and there were 200 people waiting for their bananas. I lit the burner, grabbed a sauté pan, melted unsalted butter, and mixed in brown sugar and spices. I added sliced bananas and reached for the rum. No rum. Where's the rum? I asked Glow. It's not on the trolley.
I've got it, Glow said. I'm ready to assist.
Okay, sprinkle a little rum on the bananas and I'll light the butane torch. I flicked the torch on, and Glow dumped half a bottle of rum on the bananas.
Too much, I said.
She jerked the bottle away and rum went everywhere. The bananas burst into flame, and the blue flames leaped from the pan, ran down the legs of the trolley and across the oriental carpet, and ignited the heavy brocade drapes behind me. It was instant mayhem. The fire alarm was blaring. People were screaming, shoving, running out of the room onto the terrace. A lot of black smoke was coming off the drapes. Little runners of fire were racing across the wall. I'd like to think I'd be good in an emergency, but truth is, I stood frozen, rooted to the spot, watching Rutherford and half a dozen employees rush in with fire extinguishers.
I think the party is over, Glow said. I just got a text from Josh saying that Diesel has the motor running.
I looked around the room. The fire was mostly out and it hadn't spread beyond the back wall. I didn't see Ammon. I guess we could leave, I said. The Bananas Foster station is closed. We put our heads down and quickly walked into the hall, through the empty kitchen, and into the garage where Josh was waiting, making hurry-up motions. We crossed to the van, Josh and Glow climbed into the back, and I took the seat next to Diesel.
Why the rush? I asked Diesel. Did you get the map?
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you set the house on fire, Ammon rushed up to his study to save the map and caught me leaving with it. There was a brief discussion over who was going to retain ownership, and Josh smacked him with a serving tray. I saw him leave the room and I followed him, Josh said. Good thing I did.
Oh my gosh, was he hurt? I asked.
He be a bit stunned, Josh said, reverting to pirate talk. More like he be a bit knocked out, Diesel said, putting the van in gear, but he was coming around when we left.
Police cars and fire trucks were screaming in the distance.
We need to get out of here before we're blocked in, Diesel said.
It wasn't a very long driveway, but there was valet parking and cars were lined up on either side. Diesel carefully drove toward the gate, and halfway there, a man burst out from between two cars and jumped in front of us. It was Martin Ammon. He was crazy mad, waving his arms and shouting,
Help! Police! Rutherford!
This is a real pain in the ass, Diesel said.
Diesel inched the van up to Ammon, but Ammon wouldn't budge. He banged on the hood and kept shouting.
What are you gonna do?
I asked Diesel. Run him over, Diesel said.
You can't do that, you'll kill him.
And?
You don't have permission to kill.
Extenuating circumstance, Diesel said.
Ammon gave the hood one last thump and moved to the driver's side door, trying to pull it open.
You're not leaving with my map, he yelled.
My magic eight ball is telling me that in 5 minutes this place is gonna be swarming with police, Glow said.
I'll have you arrested and you'll rot in jail, Ammon said. The police are on their way. I can hear their sirens.
Diesel rolled the van forward. Ammon staggered back, pulled out his cell phone, and dialed.
This isn't good, I said. He's calling 911.
We'll have to take him with us, Diesel said. Get him.
Glow, Josh, and I jumped out of the van and ran at Ammon. He took off down the driveway, and Josh tackled him at the gate. Diesel pulled the van up, we wrestled Ammon into the back, and Josh and Glow sat on him while I climbed into the front. There was a lot of grunting and swearing and scuffing going on in the back of the van while Diesel motored off the property and headed for the causeway. There was a loud "Ugh!" and thunk, and then there was quiet.
What just happened? I asked, trying to see beyond the racks for dishes and holding trays.
The magic eight ball jumped out of my hand and beamed Ammon, Glow said. Ammon seems to be sleeping.
Oh my God, we knocked Martin Ammon out cold twice and now we've kidnapped him, I said. We're all going to prison. My mother will have to be sedated.
I have Ripples with me, Glow said. I can put a forgetful spell on Ammon so he won't remember anything.
There was a moment of silence. No one had a lot of confidence in Glow's spell-casting abilities.
Here it is on page 37, Glow said, and I have almost all the ingredients with me.
Almost? I asked.
I'm missing the powdered newt snot, but I don't think it will matter. Powdered newt snot is mostly used as a binding agent.
Diesel smiled, and I bit into my lower lip to keep from whimpering.
Candle burn, smoke expire, Martin's brain will now retire, Glow said.
Do you have a candle back there? I asked her.
I have a Bic lighter, Glow said. I didn't bring a candle.
I heard some pages rustle.
Whoops, Glow said. I lost my place.
More pages rustling.
Here it is, she said. Brain of dog, trusted friend, remember not the sad end, but act as ever.
That doesn't sound right, I said to her.
It's dark back here, Glow said, but I'm pretty sure I got it correct.
The first police car flew past us on the other side of the road. It was followed by two more police cars and a fire truck. Maybe we should drop Ammon off at the hospital, I said to Glow. How bad is he?
He's okay, Glow said. His nose has stopped bleeding and he sort of has his eyes open.
I've got his hands tied with some rope we had back here, Josh said. I think he's secure.
So if we don't take him to the hospital, where do we take him? I asked Diesel.
Your house. I'm hungry.
No. I don't want him in my house.
Lizzie is right, Glow said. I'm pretty sure he's a demon, and he might infect Lizzie's house with demon cooties. For a second there, when we were rolling around, I thought I caught a glimpse of a double pupil in his eyes, and then they might have glowed red.
Diesel turned off Ocean Avenue onto Atlantic.
He isn't a demon. He's a narcissist with demonic ambition.
What if we take him to my house and a SWAT team shows up and crashes through my windows and breaks down my doors, I said. That would be awful.
I won't lock the front door, Diesel said. Then they can just walk in.
10 minutes later, we carted Ammon from the van and set him in my kitchen. Kat glared at him from a vantage point on the counter, and Carl gave him the finger. Diesel went off to find a parking space. Glow had her magic eight ball out.
Magic eight ball, tell me true. Is Martin Ammon a demon?
Well, I asked, what does it say?
It says, signs point to yes.
Chapter 14. Ammon was standing in the middle of my kitchen, swaying slightly, his eyes glazed, his hands tied in front of him.
Demons don't like salt, Glow said, grabbing a box of salt from my cabinet.
She poured the salt onto the floor in a circle around Ammon.
Okay, she said to Ammon. Step out of the salt circle.
Ammon didn't look like he was totally with the program.
Maybe he's confused because I put the forgetful spell on him and he doesn't remember he's a demon, Glow said.
Maybe he's confused because he was knocked out twice and has a concussion, I said. What happens to demons who cross the salt line?
I think they melt, Glow said, but that's secondhand information.
Josh gave Ammon a shove, and Ammon stumbled across the salt line.
Huh, Glow said. He's not melting.
Ammon tipped his head back and howled.
Oh my God, Glow said. He's a demon werewolf. We need to shoot him with a silver bullet. Who's got a silver bullet?
Josh and I shuffled around. We didn't have a silver bullet. We also didn't have a gun. He hasn't got fangs like a werewolf, I said. Are you sure you did the right spell? Glow thumbed through Ripples.
Here it is. Uh-oh.
What uh-oh, I asked. I hate uh-oh.
I might have made a mistake when I lost my place in the van. I think I might have put the man's best friend spell on him.
Ammon was on his knees, licking up the salt. He moved to the work island and lifted his leg.
Bad dog, I said. No.
He put his leg down and looked up at me.
Do something, I said to Glow. Change him back.
That could be a problem, Glow said.
since I seem to have made a combination of two spells. But here's the good news. I didn't have any powdered newt snot, so the spell is most likely temporary.
Diesel walked into the kitchen, set the map on the counter, and went to the refrigerator. How's it going?
Not so good, I said. Ammon thinks he's a dog.
Not my bad, Diesel said, grabbing a meat pie. And I'm not walking him.
So this is the map, Josh said, staring down at it. Hard to believe it will lead to such riches.
Diesel ate the meat pie cold like a sandwich and washed it down with the beer. He removed the map from the frame and placed the map back on the countertop. I thought Josh was right. The map didn't look like anything that would lead us to a treasure. It was a round piece of old parchment. On one side was the inscription, Denarius Clavis ad Chartem Est. There was also a rudimentary sketch of a collection of islands below the inscription. One of the islands had an X drawn onto it. The other side of the map was filled from top to bottom with seemingly random letters. A series of concentric circles drawn on the round map were the only things that seemed to separate one group of letters from another. It looked like an archery target.
This isn't a slam dunk, Glow said. The treasure could be buried anywhere on those islands. We could dig holes for 1,000 years and never find anything.
Diesel turned the map over to the side with the letters. He put the coin on the parchment. Nothing magical happened. Josh tried to rub the letters with the coin as if it was a scratch-off lottery ticket. Nothing happened.
How did you get the 7 pieces of coin to stick together? I asked Diesel.
Super glue.
Maybe it's like a Ouija board, Glow said. Maybe we just need to put the coin on the map and we all put our hands on it and the coin will move around while we chant.
It's some kind of a puzzle, I said. I'm sure we have to figure out how to use these concentric circles. I put the coin in the center circle, the bullseye. It was a perfect fit.
Oh my gosh, Glow said. There's a letter peeking out through one of the little holes in the coin.
I rotated the coin, and there were more alphabet letters. The coin has to be perfectly rotated to have letters appear in the holes, I said. Right now we have an E and an O.
We need the missing piece of the coin, Diesel said. Without that piece, it's impossible to know if the coin is oriented correctly, if we're missing letters, or even if we have the correct letters. What about the outer rings, Josh asked. They all have letters in them, too.
Diesel put the coin on top of the outermost ring. The width of the coin was exactly the width of the donut ring, the space between the outside ring and the next one. In fact, each of the concentric rings, though they formed smaller and smaller donuts, had the same exact width of approximately 1.5 inches, the same width as the diameter of the coin.
Try to rotate the coin in the outer ring and see if you can find letters in the holes, Diesel said to me.
I chose a random place within the donut ring and put the coin inside it. I rotated the coin slightly until letters were visible through the holes. I used that as my starting point and rolled the coin like the wheel of a bicycle rolling down the road so that it stayed inside the confines of the donut ring. It looked like a planet revolving around the sun. As the coin moved through its orbit, additional letters were revealed through the holes. I rolled the coin around all of the rings, and Diesel wrote down all of the letters.
This makes no sense, Diesel said, looking at what he'd written. We need the last piece of the coin from Wolf. We can't decipher the map without it.
Ammon was on his feet looking around. He spied Cat, gave a woof, and chased Cat into the living room. Cat planted his feet, hissed and swatted at Ammon, slashing a 4-inch rip in Ammon's pants leg. Ammon yelped and jumped away from Cat. I pointed at the couch.
Sit, I said to Ammon.
Ammon got on the couch, scrunched around a little, and curled up.
We have to do something with him, I said to Diesel. He can't stay here. Either we turn him over to Rutherford or else we take him to the animal shelter.
Crash!
Ammon fell off the couch.
What the heck? I said. Is he okay? I think he tried to lick his dog balls and fell off the couch, Glow said.
Rutherford arrived 15 minutes later. We were outside on the sidewalk with Ammon. Ammon was no longer bound, but Diesel had a grip on him so he wouldn't chase after cars or squirrels.
I found him on my doorstep, I said to Rutherford. He seems confused.
Ammon growled at Rutherford. He must be in shock from the traumatic fire, I said. He's not himself.
It's true, Josh said to Rutherford. He thinks he's a doggy. You'll want to watch him on the carpets.
Rutherford gaped at Ammon.
He's bloody.
Yeah, Diesel said. He might have fallen down.
Rutherford loaded Ammon into the Mercedes sedan, and they drove off with Ammon's head out the window, his nose pointed into the wind.
Go figure, Glow said.
We drove the van back to Dazzle's. We all got into our own cars and drove home. I looked in my rearview mirror and saw that Diesel was following me. I parked in my space alongside my house, and Diesel parked on the street one house down. Not going home? I asked him. We were on the sidewalk in front of my house, and Diesel looked toward the front door.
I left my monkey here, and Wolf is here.
How do you know Wolf is here?
I have a cramp in my ass.
Diesel went in first, flipped the light on, and I saw that Wolf was sitting in a chair in the living room. He looked deadly calm and perfectly at ease. He didn't blink in the sudden bright light. He didn't smile. He didn't scowl. He didn't look surprised to see Diesel.
Hello, cousin, Wolf said.
Diesel gave a small nod of recognition.
Wolf? I've been admiring the map, Wolf said. Pity it's useless without my piece of the coin. What's the deal?
Diesel asked him.
You keep the treasure, and I get the stone if I give you my piece. Not gonna happen, Diesel said. Martin Ammon looks the fool right now, but he's no fool. He's also no demon, Diesel said. There's a demon inside all of us, Wolf said. Ammon's demon is greed. He will always want more wealth and more power. He'll stop at nothing to get it. And there are those who follow him dog-like, if you'll excuse the expression. Mammon has his disciples, whether they be misguided or not. And your point? Diesel asked. My point is that for all purposes, he now owns Miss Tucker. She signed a contract that gives Ammon control of her professional future. She's been caught on security cameras kidnapping Ammon. She's in possession of stolen property from his house. He will use all this to blackmail her into helping him find the treasure. And if that doesn't work, he'll raise the stakes until she agrees. He'll burn down her house, kill her cat, and kidnap her mother and chop off her fingers one by one.
This was all said very matter-of-fact, without any emotional inflection or doubt that it would happen. It was the word of Wolf, and Diesel and I knew that everything he said was true.
Better I get the stone than Ammon and his Mammon worshippers. I can control the power. Followers of Mammon will unleash it.
We could just leave the stone hidden, I said. Even someone as crazy as Ammon would understand that we're at an impasse.
It won't stop them from chopping off your mother's fingers, Wolf said.
Even a crazy person has to realize I have no control over you and can't get you to give me the last piece, I said to Wolf. Diesel and Wolf exchanged glances.
You do have control over him, Diesel said. Wolf couldn't allow anything bad to happen to you or your family. He would have to act.
Why?
For the same reason I couldn't allow it, Diesel said. We're bound to you.
Geez, I said. I don't even know what that means.
It means there would have to be a price paid for destroying what I'm bound to protect, Wolf said. And that would be a large, tiresome project if my targets were Mammon followers.
I don't get it, I said to Wolf. You threaten me all the time.
There's me, and then there's them, Wolf said, laying his single piece of the coin on the coffee table.
Diesel took the piece and joined it to the other seven pieces. We put the coin on the map, and Diesel recorded the letters that resulted when we rolled the coin around the rings. What does it say? I asked Diesel.
In the deep water west of Gull Rock lies Babur's cursed gemstone. It may find ye a treasure, but the price be your bones.
Oh boy, I said, a cursed gemstone.
Whatever it is, you need to find it, Wolf said. Phumph.
There was a flash of light and some smoke, and Wolf was gone. How does he do that? I asked. Diesel grinned.
To tell you the truth, I don't know.
Did we just agree to give him the Stone of Avarice?
Yeah, and it doesn't make me happy, but his power is limited as long as we have two stones safely locked away. He needs all seven to do real damage.
Wolf mentioned mammon followers, I said to Diesel. Do you think they exist?
It wouldn't surprise me, and I can understand why they would gravitate to Ammon as their supreme representative.
You don't suppose he could actually be Mammon, do you?
No, I think his parents made an unfortunate choice of a first name.
What would these Mammon followers look like, I asked. Would they be like a zombie army worshipping Ammon?
My money's on Rutherford, said Diesel. He's always got Ammon in his sights, and if Rutherford is one of them, there are probably other acolytes on the household staff.
Rutherford seems unusually devoted to Ammon, but I don't know if I could see him as a mammon worshiper. He looks so normal.
My Aunt Lydia looks normal, but she belongs to a coven that elected her goddess of the daisies.
You have a strange family, I said.
Not by California standards.
I poured myself a glass of wine and chugged half. About tonight. Diesel was relaxed against a counter, thumbs hooked into his pants pockets, tie loosened, top button to his shirt open.
You had to drink half a glass of wine before you brought it up.
Is there a problem with that?
Not on my end, Diesel said.
Here's the thing, I said. I'm sort of creeped out to stay here by myself. Wolf pops in whenever he wants, and I'm worried that Ammon will realize he's not a dog and I have his map.
So you want me to spend the night?
Yes.
Where am I sleeping?
Wherever you want, I told him.
This is too easy.
I thought you liked easy.
I'm good at my job because I have superior instincts, and my instincts tell me this isn't going to end well.
You're doing me a favor by staying here. The least I can do is offer you my bed, being that you don't fit on the couch.
And?
And I'll sleep down here, I said.
Because?
Because I don't want to take any chances on having to save the world all by myself.
I thought we'd figured that one out, Diesel said.
What if it was a fluke? Like, what if someone had just been asleep at the switch? There's a lot at stake right now. Diesel helped himself to the wine and refilled my glass.
Let me know if you change your mind. I'm good on short notice.
I changed my mind at 10 o'clock when we shut the television off. Maybe we could try the pillow thing again, I said. You stay on your side, and I'll stay on my side. He wrapped his hand around my wrist and tugged me toward the stairs.
It would be easier if I had Hatchet.
He's a nut.
True, but I have no desire to get him naked.
I don't suppose you'd want to sleep with your clothes on. He tossed his jacket over a chair.
Don't suppose I would, but feel free to wear whatever you want.
I grabbed some flannel pajamas and changed in the bathroom. Diesel was already in bed when I came out.
It's July, Diesel said. Don't you think you'll be hot in flannel pajamas?
They feel cozy.
I bet.
Chapter 15. My smartphone alarm buzzed me awake. The room was pitch black. I could feel Cat curled at my feet. I was cuddled next to Diesel. No pillows. I checked my pajamas. Still buttoned. Still on me. I eased out of bed, found some clothes in the dark, and went into the bathroom. I was showered and dressed in 15 minutes. Diesel was still sleeping.
No, I'm not, Diesel said.
I turned the light on.
That doesn't mean I want the light on, he said.
I turned the light off and went downstairs with Cat close on my heels. I made coffee, fed Cat, and toasted a bagel. I hung my tote bag on my shoulder, poured my coffee in a to-go cup, and took a bite of the bagel. Carl was asleep on the couch with the nightlight on. I crossed the room, unlocked the front door, and was knocked back when the door was shoved open. Josh and Devereaux rushed into the room. Devereaux held me at gunpoint while Josh went to the kitchen and returned with the coin, the map, and the paper Diesel had copied the letters onto. What the heck? I said.
$190 million be a lot of money, Josh said, heading for the door with the map tucked under his arm.
It was so unexpected, it took a beat for me to put it together. They were stealing everything and going after the treasure.
Diesel, I yelled. Diesel!
I dropped my coffee, bagel, and tote bag and ran after Devereaux, grabbing him by the back of his jacket. He whirled around and caught me on the side of my head with the gun butt.
Josh looked over at me. Are you okay?
No, I said.
Blood was dripping off the side of my face onto my sweatshirt, and my ears were ringing.
Devereaux raced toward a car parked half on the sidewalk in front of my house.
Get in the car, he yelled at Josh.
Sorry, Josh said to me. Ye be a comely lass, but I best do this.
Ye be an a-hole, I yelled after him. Best you get herpes.
Arrgh, he said,
and they drove away.
Diesel came up beside me. What's going on?
Devereaux and Josh just took off with the map and the coin.
I turned and looked at Diesel. He was naked.
Holy cow, I said.
You got me out of bed.
A car drove by and beeped. Diesel waved and closed the front door and locked it.
You have a gash on the side of your head, Diesel said. How'd that happen?
I took my sweatshirt off, pressed it against the cut, and went to the kitchen.
Devereaux hit me with his gun. It stunned me long enough for them to get away.
It's disappointing that Josh threw in with Devereaux. I didn't see that coming.
He moistened a kitchen towel and cleaned the area around the cut.
It's not so bad, he said. It's not deep and the bleeding is stopping.
He got a giant Band-Aid from my kitchen first aid kit.
Relax while I get dressed.
Damn, he was gonna get dressed. Bummer.
That's the sort of thinking that will get you into trouble, Diesel said.
You're reading my mind again.
I wasn't reading your mind, Diesel said. You were licking your lips and staring.
Diesel was wearing washed-out jeans, a black t-shirt, and running shoes. His hair was still damp from a shower, and he had a two-day beard. He popped half a bagel into the toaster and helped himself to coffee. I was rinsing my coffee mug in the sink when I sensed someone at the back door. I looked over and saw Rutherford staring in at us. Diesel opened the door to him.
How's it going? Diesel said.
Well, the truth is, it could be going better, Rutherford said. Mr. Ammon is upset that his map is missing, and he would like to have it back.
Sorry, Diesel said. We don't have it.
Perhaps you might check around, just to be sure, Rutherford said.
He was smiling and making patty cake gestures with his hands.
Not here, Diesel said.
Rutherford kept smiling.
Here's the thing. It isn't that I doubt your word, but we have video of you taking it.
That was yesterday, Diesel said. You're an hour late. Someone just stole it.
Rutherford gave a short burst of polite laughter.
Of course I believe you, but Mr. Ammon might not believe it, that someone could just waltz in here and steal it.
Everyone waltzes in here, Diesel said. It happens all the time.
I was hit on the head with a gun, I said, pointing to my Band-Aid.
I'm so sorry,
Rutherford said, looking at the Band-Aid, his face a study in agonized concern.
I'll do my best to explain this to Mr. Ammon. Yes, yes.
Diesel closed the door after Rutherford left and topped off his coffee.
You're getting a lot of traffic in here today.
I set my mug in the dish drain. Do you think Devereaux and Josh will be able to find the island?
Devereaux probably always knew where the island was located. It was crudely drawn on the bottom of the map, and he had the map long enough to conduct research. Ammon has probably always known where the island is, too, and most likely both of them have searched every square inch of it and found nothing. They were dead-ended without the coin to read the message on the map.
What about us? Do we know where the island is?
Yep. I took a picture of the map last night and sent it to a guy I know who spent a lot of time sailing these waters. The cluster of small islands is in Penobscot Bay. My guy said it wasn't hard to find the target island because it has a unique shape. It's called Brimstone Island, and he also knew about Gull Rock.
The name Brimstone Island doesn't exactly conjure up thoughts of a tropical paradise. I checked the time. I have to run. I'm going to be late for work.
Correction. You're going to be missing. You need to call in for another Save the World Day. We need to get to Brimstone Island before Devereaux.
Can we do that? He has a head start.
I've mapped it out. It takes about 4 hours to get to Rockland, Maine. From there, it's a two-hour ferry ride to the Fox Islands. Then it's necessary to hire a boat to get to Brimstone. It's about an eight-hour trip total. Fortunately, we have resources that probably aren't available to Devereaux.
And that would be?
A fast boat. Wolf is meeting us at the wharf in an hour.
I called Clara and told her I wouldn't be in. Sunday was a slow day, and she'd be able to manage the cider donuts on her own. Glow could help her with cleanup. We took Diesel's car to Pickering Wharf Marina, parked, and walked to the dock. I don't see Wolf's boat, I said. It's the orange one on the end. That's not the boat I was on. The boat you were on is too slow for our purposes. This is a 51-foot Nortec 5000V. It tops out at 120 miles per hour. We won't be going that fast today, but we'll be going faster than Devereaux.
How many boats does Wolf have?
Diesel shrugged. They come and go.
Do you have a boat?
I have a hammock and a surfboard.
The boat was long and low with an open cockpit. Wolf was at the helm. Hatchet was in the co-pilot seat. There were three seats behind them. I counted 18 dials on the console and more to the left of the wheel. The hatch leading to below decks was also to the left of the wheel. Decking was teak. Seats were red leather. I got on board and took a seat. Diesel stood behind Wolf. Wolf hit the ignition switch, and the boat rumbled to life. Wolf maneuvered us away from the slip and into the harbor. He was in his usual black. His hair was pulled back into a ponytail at the nape of his neck. His eyes were hidden behind mirrored sunglasses. I wondered if he was wearing sunscreen. We reached open water. He pushed the throttle forward, and the boat took off. Diesel and Wolf looked like this was business as usual. Hatchet looked like he was going to throw up. And I was breathless. We reached Penobscot Bay at mid-morning. The sea was calm and the sun was shining. Wolf slowed and cruised along, following the coordinates from Diesel's boat guy.
That's Brimstone straight ahead, Wolf said.
It looked like a cupcake with green icing. In reality, it was a massive hunk of rock with just enough topsoil for trees to grow. We circled the island, keeping our eyes open for Gull Rock. Most of the coastline consisted of ledges and boulders, but we found a small sand beach on the north side of the island and a larger beach on the west side. The west side beach was packed with people. A tiki hut had been erected on the beach and music carried across the water to us. Small boats were moored a few feet from shore.
I thought this was supposed to be a lost, deserted island, Diesel said.
Wolf scanned the beach with binoculars.
The sign on the tiki hut says Brimstone Bar and Grill. It looks like a nudie beach for seniors.
Diesel took the binoculars from Wolf.
Whoa!
He grinned and handed the binoculars to me, but I passed. I was happy to have old age creep up on me. I didn't want a full frontal preview. We returned to the north side of the island where there were a lot of rock outcroppings.
There, Diesel said, pointing out to sea. Gull Rock, according to my source. It's the chunk of rock that looks like bird wings, and it's filled with gulls. There's probably good fishing around it.
Wolf motored around the rock, watching the fish finder and side-scan sonar. He enlarged his circle and found a wreck on the second pass. He cut the engine and dropped anchor.
What's the depth on the wreck? Diesel asked him.
Not deep. Looks like about 25 meters.
In feet? I asked.
About 80, Diesel said. I could free dive that, but I can stay down longer with tanks.
They're in the salon, Wolf said.
Are you diving too? I asked him.
No, Wolf said. I drive and he dives.
Wolf put out a dive flag, and Diesel changed into a wetsuit and scuba gear. He went over the side and disappeared into the dark water. He reappeared after 20 minutes and hoisted himself onto the boat.
It's a relatively small wreck, Diesel said, shrugging out of the scuba gear. Looked like a fishing vessel that was intentionally scuttled. Didn't look disturbed. Not much of value in it, with the exception of this chest.
Diesel handed Wolf a net pouch with a small barnacle-encrusted box in it. Wolf took the box out of the net and opened it.
At first glance, I'd say I'm looking at the blue diamond.
Diesel took the diamond out of the box and put it in my hand.
Do you feel anything?
A small vibration and some heat.
It's cold when it's in my hand, Diesel said.
It's not glowing, I said. Devereaux told us it glows blue when it approaches a stone.
I'm sure it needs to be closer to the stone to do that, Diesel said. There was nothing else down there, and clearly it's empowered by the stone if you feel a vibration.
Boat approaching, sire, Hatchet said.
We all turned our attention to the boat.
It was a center console about half our size, and it was traveling at a good speed, pushed by two outboards. Wolf had the binoculars up.
"Professor Devereaux and a mate," he said. "Hatchet, raise the anchor and stow the dive flag."
The boat came up on us, swerved, and sped away. It whipped around and came to a stop at some distance with its prow aimed in our direction.
"What's going on?" Diesel asked.
"Devereaux is angry. The mate looks worried," Wolf said, binoculars still trained on them.
"I'm sure Devereaux isn't happy to find we got here first," Diesel said.
Wolf moved to the wheel and hit the ignition.
"Devereaux just shouldered a handheld rocket launcher. We need to move now. Hang on."
Chapter 16. The twin turbines roared and our boat jumped forward. I saw the flash from the rocket launcher, and then I was flying through the air. I went underwater, kicked my way to the surface, and struggled to stay afloat. Debris from Wolf's boat was all around me. A seat cushion floated by, and I grabbed hold. I was too stunned to hear the smaller boat approach, and still stunned when I was dragged out of the water. I lay on the floor of the boat, catching my breath, clutching the seat cushion.
"What?"
I said, jostled by the motion of the boat as it raced through the water. Josh was on his knees next to me.
"Are you okay?" he asked.
His face was white, and he looked shaken. I pushed myself up to a sitting position, and Josh helped me get to my feet and pivot onto the bench seat in the back of the boat.
"What happened?" I asked.
"He blew you out of the water," Josh said. "He's nuts. He blew that boat to smithereens."
"Why?"
"The treasure. He's obsessed with it. I admit I joined up with him to get some money and go on a treasure hunt, but it's like all of a sudden he's nutso. It wasn't supposed to be like this. He said it would be a lark, a race to the finish with winner take all."
I looked back at the wreckage. "Diesel and Wolf."
"They've surfaced," Josh said. "They're floating on something. There's a third mate, too."
"That would be Stephen Hatchet."
I looked down at my hand. I was still holding on to the blue diamond.
"Whoa," Josh said. "What is that?"
Devereaux stepped away from the console and looked at the diamond.
"It's the finder," he said. "It's the blue diamond of Babur. I never thought I would have this opportunity, but here I am. You were the critical missing element, and now I have everything I need to claim the treasure, and Ammon has nothing."
"Wow, that's great," I said. "Good for you. Maybe since you have it all, we should go back and pick up the men who are floating in the ocean."
"I don't need them. I hope they drown."
Not an unexpected answer since a man blew up our boat, but it sent a chill through me all the same.
"You alone can find the treasure," Devereaux said. "It's in the diary, and it's in the writings of Mammon. The guide will find the way. You're the guide."
"I thought you weren't a follower of Mammon."
"I'm not a believer. I'm a historian. When I find the treasure, my name will be listed with the greatest historians and treasure hunters of all time."
"Not to mention you'll be shockingly rich," Devereaux smiled.
"That too."
"If those three men drown back there, you'll also be listed as a murderer," I said.
"Who will accuse me? Josh, he's an accomplice, and no one will believe you. You're just a hysterical, delusional female."
I was soaking wet and shivering, and I worried that he might be right about the delusional and hysterical part. There was definitely an element of unreality to all this, and I could feel the hysteria twitching in my chest, ready to burst out at any moment. Devereaux returned to the controls and directed the boat toward shore. He had a semi-automatic pistol shoved into his pants pocket, and I thought he was wacko enough to use it.
"Here's how this will play out," Devereaux said. "I've studied the map, and I'm going to beach this boat in the most likely starting point that will lead us to the treasure."
"How does the finder work?" I asked.
"According to the diary, the finder will want to join with the stone, so it will emit energy as it gets closer."
"It will glow," I said.
"Yes. I thought the finder might be the blue diamond, but I wasn't sure. I personally feel like Palgrave Bellows made this whole treasure hunt more complicated than it had to be, but it is what it is."
"Suppose I don't want to do this," I said.
Devereaux looked at Josh.
"I'll kill him." "Arg," Josh said. "Best not be hasty."
"True," Devereaux said.
I'll just shoot off some fingers, maybe an ear.
It's not good to be missing an ear, Josh said. I'm fond of them both.
Devereaux followed the rocky shoreline until he came to a small patch of sand in a protected cove. He nosed the boat in as far as he could, and when he started to churn sand, he raised the engines.
Take a line and pull us in, he said to Josh. Secure the line to the tree at the edge of the shore. We're at dead low tide. The boat will be floating when we return.
Josh grabbed the line and jumped into the knee-high water. He pulled the boat in as far as it would go, waded out of the water, and walked to the tree. When he got to the tree, he looked back at us and put his hand to his ear, no doubt thinking he didn't want to lose it. He dropped the rope and ran off into the woods. Oops, I said. Devereaux fired off two shots, but Josh continued to crash through the brush, so I assumed he wasn't hit, or at least not badly. This isn't going well, I said. Why don't I give you the diamond and you can find the treasure all by yourself? Devereaux hung a beat-up knapsack on his shoulder and pointed the gun at me.
Because that might not work. It's not clear if the diamond will glow for an ordinary person. Wade into the beach and tie up the boat. I'll be right behind you, and I'll shoot you if you decide to follow him.
I tied the boat to the tree and set off on a path that led into the woods. I came to a fork in the path. Devereaux pulled a folded map of the island out of the knapsack, studied it for a moment, and told me to go left. I was still dripping wet, and my shoes leaked water with every step. I looked at the chosen route and cringed. The rock-strewn trail wound uphill to a granite ledge.
What's the finder telling you? Devereaux asked.
It's not telling me anything. It's a little warm, but that's all.
Keep moving, Devereaux said.
I was struggling to follow a narrow dirt path that was littered with rocks and sporadically overgrown with tangled vines. Thorny shrubs and stunted evergreens hugged the trail, obscuring the view. I could hear Devereaux laboring behind me. I reached the granite ledge, and the evergreens gave way enough for me to see the surf crashing onto the rocks far below me. The cove where we tied the boat was no longer in sight. I looked at the diamond and sucked in some air. The diamond was glowing. The light in the gemstone was very faint, but definitely there. Devereaux saw it too.
I knew it, he said. It's going to lead us to the treasure.
His voice was hoarse, and his face was red from the exertion of the climb. His eyes were glazed, his pupils narrow pinpoints of insanity. Do you have the coin on you? I asked him.
Of course.
Is it in anything, like a lead box?
It's in my pocket.
It's occurred to me that it might be affecting your behavior, I said. I don't mean to be rude or anything, but you're a little nutso. You're not really yourself. Maybe you should sit and rest, catch your breath.
No time for that. Ammon could be following us.
I didn't think he had to worry about Ammon as much as he had to worry about Diesel and Wolf. I was confident that they were on the hunt, looking for me. Now that I was on the granite ledge, there was no path to follow. It was all rock with patches of scrub forest. I chose a direction at random, and the diamond stopped glowing. I backtracked and went off in another direction, and the light returned. We were climbing over boulders and bushwhacking through brambles. I had scratches on my arms where I'd caught thorns, and my jeans were torn at the knee from skidding down a rock slide. From time to time, I'd turn and check on Devereaux, hoping he'd fall behind enough for me to escape. So far, he was keeping up, trudging along with the gun in his hand, his eyes bright with crazed excitement. I had to stop and backtrack again twice when the diamond went dim, but for 20 minutes now, the glow had been getting steadily stronger. I approached what at first looked like a dead end, but turned out to be a narrow canyon made by two slabs of granite. The distance between the slabs was 3 feet at best, and the walls were 30 to 40 feet high. I stepped into the slot, looked up at the ribbon of blue sky far above me, and felt a rush of panic burn in my chest. I can't go in there, I said to Devereaux. It's too narrow. We'll get trapped.
There's plenty of room. What does the diamond say?
I had the diamond in my pocket so he couldn't see it, but the stupid thing was glowing through the denim. There has to be an easier way to get to the treasure, I said. We should go back and try a different route.
We're not going back. We're following the diamond. Give it to me. Hand it over.
I gave him the diamond, and it went cold. No glow, no heat, nothing.
I guess you're not the guide, I said.
Lucky for you, but that doesn't mean you're not expendable. I've gotten this far, and I have a map. If you cease to be useful to me, I'll eliminate you and go it alone.
You won't find the treasure on your own.
So be it then.
I didn't like the word eliminate. The prospect of being eliminated was even less desirable than threading my way through the slot. I put my head down and walked forward, putting one foot in front of the other. I watched my feet. I didn't look up, and I didn't look ahead. The narrow passageway seemed to go on forever, and then suddenly I was in bright sunlight and in an open space that was shaped like a bowl. The rocky sides of the bowl were maybe 30 feet high, and the bowl was 30 or 40 feet across. Not huge, but I could breathe easier. Problem was, I didn't see a way out of the bowl other than the way we came in. Now what? I asked Devereaux.
Walk around and see what happens to the diamond.
I set off around the perimeter of the pit, and a third of the way the diamond began to pulse with light. 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed any of this, but since Diesel popped into my life, I was willing to believe almost anything, and I have to admit it was hard not to get excited about the pulsing diamond. I looked up at the rim of the bowl high above me, hoping to see Diesel or Wolf, but there was only blue sky.
Keep walking, Devereaux said.
I continued picking my way along the bottom of the bowl, and after a couple minutes, the diamond stopped pulsing.
Go back, Devereaux said. The treasure must be back with the boulders.
There was an outcropping of loose rock and large boulders in the area where the diamond pulsed. A clump of scruffy bushes and scraggly evergreens grew in the thin soil around the boulders. Mostly there was granite ledge under our feet. No place to bury a treasure chest. I kicked through the bushes and found a fissure in the rock wall behind a man-sized boulder. Devereaux took a couple flashlights out of his knapsack. He handed one to me, and he kept the other.
Look around, he said. What do you see?
I stuck my head in and flicked the light on. The fissure appeared to form a natural tunnel. From what I could see, it was damp, dark, and no place I wanted to go. It was at best 3 feet wide, and it was difficult to determine the height. I might be able to stand, but there wouldn't be a lot of clearance.
Well? Devereaux asked.
Looks like a dead end, I said.
No, it doesn't. It looks like a tunnel. I can see from here. It's going to lead us to the treasure. Get in there.
No way. Shoot me. I'd rather die here than in that tomb.
It's not a tomb, you ninny. It's a treasure trove. It's the path to immortality.
He was very close to me, and the gun was shaking in his hand.
This is too important for me to walk away, Devereaux said. It's my destiny, my legacy, and you're going to help me.
I don't think so. Take the diamond. Good riddance. Good luck. I heard the whoop, whoop, whoop sound of a helicopter overhead, and a shadow fell over Devereaux and me. My first thought was of Diesel and Wolf, but I looked up and saw Ammon Enterprises written in black and gold on the white chopper. Hard to tell if I was relieved or even more terrified.
Bastards, Devereaux shouted.
He squeezed off two shots at the helicopter, and it disappeared over the edge of the bowl.
They aren't getting my treasure, he said, pointing the gun at me. We have to hurry. Lead the way to the cave or I'll shoot you.
How do you know the treasure is in a cave?
It's always either in a cave or buried, and nothing is going to be buried on this godforsaken piece of rock. I'm counting to three, and then I'm going to shoot you in the foot if you don't start walking.
How do you know the treasure is still there? It's been hundreds of years.
Three,
Devereaux said, and he fired off a shot at my foot. The bullet caught the side of my sneaker and ripped a hole in it.
Damn, Devereaux said. Hold still so I can try again.
Stop, I said. I'm going in. Chapter 17. I edged my way into the tunnel and cautiously moved forward. Even with the flashlight, it was difficult to see more than a few feet ahead. I kept telling myself that the tunnel had to lead somewhere, and that the somewhere would be better than this claustrophobic tube. I could hear Devereaux behind me sliding on the slick, uneven rock surface. He was mumbling and swearing, and I was worried that he would lose his footing and accidentally shoot me. After what seemed like an eternity, I reached a fork. One side went left, and the other side was a hole in the ground. I moved left, and the diamond dimmed. I went back, and looked at the black hole. It was like an elevator shaft dropping off into the darkness. I played the flashlight beam around the sides of the hole and saw that there were stairs carved out of the rock spiraling down into the unknown.
Go, Devereaux said. We have to get to the treasure first. I have to claim it as my own.
That's not going to do you any good if they come in and shoot you, I said.
I'll shoot them first. I'll kill them all. I should have done that long ago anyway.
This was all Diesel's fault. My life was just fine until he barged into it. Now look at me. I'm being held at gunpoint by a homicidal maniac who's getting crazier by the minute. These stairs are narrow and slippery, I said, and there's no handrail. My suggestion is to hide in the part of the tunnel that goes to the left and let Ammon and whoever is with him plunge to their death all on their own. Then we can get some equipment, like rock climbing stuff, and safely explore the road to hell.
You will go to hell now, Devereaux said. Now!
His face was contorted into a snarl, and his eyes glittered in the ambient glow from his flashlight. You're a little scary, I said to him. You should try to calm yourself.
I'll calm myself when I get my treasure. Now move. I hear voices. The demons must be in the tunnel.
Demons?
Demon worshippers might as well be demons. Ammon and his followers. He probably had the helicopter filled with the greedy bastards. They're all looking for that stupid stone that will turn Ammon back into his true form.
And his true form would be?
Mammon, of course, the god of greed.
I blew out a sigh. Diesel was missing in action, and I was going to have to save the world all by myself. I couldn't stand by and let the god of greed get the stone. I carefully tested the first couple steps, keeping my shoulder pressed to the rock wall. They weren't as slippery as I'd originally feared. If I took my time and didn't lose focus, I thought I'd be okay. I counted as I crept down the steps. 26, and I still couldn't see the bottom. I paused to gather myself together, and Devereaux prodded me with the gun barrel.
Move, he said. They're getting closer. I hear footsteps.
His hearing was a lot better than mine. I couldn't hear anything over the pounding of my heart. I was in a cold sweat from the fear of falling and the exertion of controlling my panic. I went down four more steps and realized Devereaux was holding back. He was turned slightly, looking up at the shaft's entrance, his flashlight in one hand and his gun in the other. I suspected he was going to shoot whoever stuck their head over the edge. Not something I wanted to think about. My focus was on the next step and the step after that. I directed my light down for a moment and was able to see the bottom of the pit. That was a good sign, but I still needed to stay vigilant. High above me, a spotlight blinked on, lighting the entire staircase. Devereaux fired a shot at the spotlight, lost his footing, and stepped off into space. His arms windmilled out like a cartoon character's. He found nothing to grab, and he plunged straight down. I closed my eyes and didn't open them again until I heard him hit bottom. I fought back a wave of nausea and took another step. Get to the bottom, I thought.